So I think this is a wonderful opportunity to have a conversation about bullying from a public health perspective. So my talk is really going to be about coping strategies, and I think this gets to your question. We know that bullying and other types of victimization experiences are sort of ubiquitous among youth, but not all youth manifest similar mental health outcomes. So what are youth doing to grapple with this sort of pervasive discrimination? And I'm going to be talking about that today. I have no relationships to disclose. So I'm going to give a little bit of a background on coping among adolescents. It's a very limited field of research, but there's some interesting findings coming out. And then I'm going to talk about my specific study and then hopefully have a larger conversation about some of the implications for research and for policy. So what do we know about coping styles among adolescents? Sort of Lazarus came out in 1984 with the stress and coping framework, which is sort of the predominant theory that drives coping work. And coping is really not a static phenomenon. You're just not one type of coper. You generally cope differently depending on the situation. So it's really thought of as a process. It's iterative. And these are both behavioral and emotional strategies to deal with stressors. So generally among adolescents, there's sort of four main factors of coping that have been replicated across studies. Distractive-based coping, avoidance, active, and support-seeking. And under certain circumstances, there has been theories and some empirical evidence to support that certain types of coping may be less adaptive in certain situations. So for example, when the situation is not controllable, avoidance coping is thought to be potentially more protective, that you're just avoiding the situation because you can't change it. And hopefully I'll present some findings to not say that that's true. The other thing is I think we need to think more nuanced about coping, especially for youth who are experiencing multiple forms of stressors. They're sort of deemed complex copers, where they're using lots of different coping strategies as opposed to just one. And more specifically with discrimination and bullying research, there's some research among adults to say that adults who are experiencing racism specific as a stressor generally use different types of coping than other stressors. So they generally use more support seeking in the face of racism versus other types of stressors. So this is to say that the type of stressor is going to influence the type of coping strategy employed, but really less research is done among adolescents to know that relationship between the type of stressor and the coping strategy. So most of my work has been focused on what I call identity attributions. So not only do we need to know the prevalence of bullying and discrimination, we need to know why you think it's happening to them. Because how they attribute cause to victimization experiences is going to completely change both their own personal health and how they make meaning of the situation. So a causal attribution is basically, why did I think this happened to me? And I think this quote here from an article that Daily wrote, it's a qualitative study among sexual minority youth of color. So these are youth that have multiple marginalized identity. And this young man says, "You get bashed because you're queer. No, 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 it happened because I'm black, and it's never that clear." So youth are undergoing a very complicated set of processes to understand why this happened to me. Is it because of my identity? Is it because of multiple forms of my identity? And the relationship between identity-based discrimination and coping strategies is really vastly understudied, mainly because many of our bullying measures don't ask youth to attribute why you think this happened to you. So there's some research to say that the effectiveness of any coping strategy is going to be determined by lots of different things about you, so individual characteristics, have you experienced this type of discrimination before, the frequency of the stressor, is this something you're experiencing every day, is it chronic, the context, is this happening in my school versus at home, and the attribution, why I think this is happening, and that's what I'm going to focus on today. So I love theory, so I wanted to mention the three theories that inform this work because I think it's really important that we are connecting our research to theoretical frameworks. As I mentioned, the stress and coping framework by Lazarus. And then building on that, there's the biopsychosocial model, which is specifically about racial discrimination. And racial discrimination is thought as a stressor. And that's how I view bullying and discrimination. They're stressors, and we should be thinking about stress and coping from that framework. And lastly, there's a sociological theory called intersectionality. And it's pretty powerful yet abstract. And it basically is forcing us to think about identities in a more complex way. And that quote that I read in the previous slide really highlights that we're not just made up of one identity at one time, we're multiple identities at the same time, and we need to be examining how identities overlap and how that influences bullying. I'm going to move on. So I'm going to tell you about the sample that I use. This is from a Boston Youth Survey, which was run from the Harvard Youth Violence Prevention Center. And it's among Boston public schools. So 18 schools were sampled in 2006. And the survey is really geared towards violence. There's a lot of questions on gang membership, gun control, all of that. And then they had a really interesting set of questions on discrimination, which is why I wanted to use this sample. And reflective of Boston public high school students, it's extremely racially and ethnically diverse, which is another added advantage because we really know less about bullying and discrimination among youth of color. And most students were 16, so they're sophomores in high school. So the first part of this research, which I gave a talk last year about, but I have to talk about it because it sort of leads to the coping, I wanted to see how types of attributions were clustering, right? So are students experiencing multiple forms of discrimination and bullying? So they were prompted with this question, which I think is really powerful. Sometimes people feel they are discriminated against or treated badly by other people. Did any of these happen because of your race, ethnicity, or color? Because you or your family are from another country? Because someone perceived you as gay, lesbian, or bisexual, or because of your weight? And then there was a follow-up question, were you ever bullied or physically assaulted for these reasons? So youth are being primed with two different words here, both discrimination and bullying. And so I ran a latent class analysis, which I'm happy to talk about methods afterwards, to see how these types of attributes were co-occurring, because youth could check off as many as they've had. So the yellow line here among youth who really experienced no discrimination. And then sort of what's most interesting is the blue group is sort of the racial discrimination group. These are kids who are saying, I experienced racial discrimination. And then the green group is predominantly dominated by sexual orientation. These are the students who are saying, I was discriminated or bullied because of someone thought that I was gay, lesbian, or bisexual. And then the red group is what I'm calling the intersectional group, because these are the students who are experiencing multiple forms of discrimination and bullying because of their race, because of their weight, and they're being physically assaulted. So these students might be more at risk. So I wanted to see not only how the groups were clustering, but how they were associated with mental health outcomes. So I looked at depression, suicidal ideation, and intentional self-harm. And across all three outcomes, the students who were in the green group, the green group sexual orientation or the intersectional group had much higher relationships with these outcomes. So this is saying that these students, their relationship with mental health is different than the students who experience just racial discrimination. And why do we think that is? And this is consistent with other findings that have showed that among African American and Caribbean black youth who attribute their discrimination to their weight as opposed to their race have higher rates of depression. And I'm happy to talk about why I think this might be, but I wanted to look at, are they using different coping strategies? Is that going to help explain these differential associations? And you can see the magnitude of the relationship between intentional self-harm and suicidal ideation is upwards of 7 as an odds ratio. That's huge. So for this specific study, I wanted to see, now that I know how discrimination is co-occurring, can coping strategies help explain these differential associations? So this is my analytic plan. Again, happy to talk about latent class analysis. It's basically like a clustering type of where you're letting the data empirically tell you how groups overlap. So the students were asked to pick two things that they do most often when they're upset. This isn't a great coping measure, and I'm happy to talk about the limitations afterwards, but it's still something that's important to look at. So I grouped the coping strategies based on what was found previously in the literature, and then I wanted to see, are youth using multiple at the same time? So again, I used a latent class analysis, and nothing here is new. Again, we have distractive, support, and avoidance. So I found basically what other authors have found. There's generally three types of coping. But the most interesting thing is the relationship between the type of coping that the students employed and the type of discrimination they were experiencing. So there was a significant interaction. So if you direct yourself to the red boxes, I know there's a lot of numbers on this screen, particularly here. So students who are in the sexual orientation class who are using avoidance coping have 4 times higher odds of depression compared if they had used distractive. So using avoidance coping in this situation is not adaptive. They have much higher rates of depression. And if you're in the intersectional class, which is that class which is you experience a lot of different forms of discrimination and coping, and you use support, it was protective against depression. So support is actually something that we should be telling youth to do. Don't avoid situations you can't control. And then this is basically another plot of that exact relationship. I did predictive margins, which are basically like, if everyone in the sample experienced sexual orientation discrimination and youth avoidant, they would have a score of depression of 22, which is at the ceiling of the depression measure. So this is a high, high level of depression. So this is not a strategy that we should be advocating for youth to do. Do not avoid. So some of the limitations I want to point out is the coping wasn't directly tied to the discrimination measure. It asked youth, what do you do most often when you're upset, not what do you do after you've experienced victimization. So I'm making a broad jump between those two. It's also cross-sectional, so I can't really look at anything longitudinally. However, it's a novel approach of looking at the types of attributions of bullying and discrimination. To my knowledge, no other study has looked at how are youth making meaning of this situation. So in conclusion, adolescents are experiencing multiple attributes of discrimination and bullying simultaneously, and we need to be looking at that. And that there are differential associations between the type of discrimination you're experiencing, the coping strategy you employ, and lots of mental health outcomes. And it seems avoidant coping strategies are really the most detrimental to our youth. So I think there's a couple implications of this, mainly for research and practice. I think I'd love to push the field of bullying and discrimination to be looking at measurements of why you think this happens, so both qualitatively and quantitatively. And then I think we really need to connect the bullying and discrimination research traditions. When I talk about those two words together, people often get confused. And I think bullying is not a word we should be using when it's about identity, because actually the Office of Civil Rights wrote a Dear Colleague letter to schools in 2010 saying, if there are students in your schools that have been bullied for federally protected groups, this is discrimination, you need to report it to the Office of Civil Rights. So I think we need to be using the word discrimination in context where it's useful. And finally, school-based bullying laws are only great when they have enumeration clauses, so I think we need to push all schools to think about enumeration. I want to acknowledge my other co-authors, and I'm losing my voice already. It's 9 o'clock. And thank you, and I'm happy to take questions. Yeah.
So some of the research that I've read has suggested that
yeah.
in classrooms where there are more ethnically mm-hmm. diverse, there's actually less bullying.
Yeah.
They kind of draw power theory when it comes to bullying.
Right.
That because there's no dominant
group. Yeah. Yeah. So the next step of this is doing a multi-level where I'm actually modeling the schools that have higher proportions of both racial ethnic minority students and also proportion of overweight students. So there's been comparable research to show that schools where there are a higher proportion of overweight students, there are less weight-based bullying in those schools because it's your norm, right? It's relative to your context, and that's why I think understanding bullying in relation to the context is really important because that also helps you make meaning. If everyone else in this class looks like me, maybe it's not because of my race, because everyone here is also my same race. But if it's because of my sexual orientation, because not everyone here looks like that. So I think the work around the ethnic diversity in schools has only been connected to racial bullying, but how that affects other types of bullying, I don't know. But it's definitely an important thing to look at the context and how that mediates the type of bullying that's happening. Because regardless, there's always going to be a differentiating factor. Even if everyone looks the same for one identity, there's always going to be something differentiating, whether it's clothes or hair or something. Yeah.
Yeah. One more question?
Yeah. You said that the supportive type of bullying mm-hmm. is the most protective. Do you have an idea, taking that out, as to what that specifically means to them?
Or yeah.
What do you find?
So the way that it was asked, and the question is, do you talk to your friends on the phone? Do you talk to your family? So it's talking to other people. And it doesn't even necessarily have to be about that instance, but it's knowing that you have a support system to fall back behind. And there's a whole host of literature to support being a part of your group is protective against feeling that your group doesn't belong. And I think that's why the racial discrimination group had lower levels of depression, because higher racial identity is protective against the effects of discrimination, but you don't see that with weight-based discrimination and sexual minority discrimination, because generally there might not be that in-group to fall back behind, because that identity isn't something that you, A, might be safe enough to say that this is who I'm part of, or B, something that you're actually proud of. So it's more complicated. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, one more question, and then we'll reserve the rest of the questions for after the session, if we could, please.
Well, I was just wondering if the difference between race and, for instance, weight or sexual orientation is people think, kids think race, I'm born that way, whereas they may not, they think sexual orientation or weight is my fault.
Totally. And qualitatively, we know that's true. There's a fabulous study that was actually done in 1998 out of Minnesota among overweight African-American girls, and they said that weight-based discrimination was more personal and more hurtful because they were prepared for racial discrimination. Their parents told them, this is a race-based society, this is what's going to happen to you, so they were prepared, and they didn't expect. So it's also, not only is it about volitional control, but it's also being prepared to deal with that type of bullying and discrimination. Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you.